I'm now going to begin. I am Zithulele Christopher Mzaneli from South Africa, and our topic this morning reads, "The Plight of My People, a Socio-Political History of the Apartheid State." But perhaps before we move into the subject matter proper, I'd like to get us ease off with a little joke. A couple of years ago, I studied in the Midwest for a Bachelor of Divinity degree. And when I finished that, I flew to New York City and spent 4 days in New York. I fellowshiped with a group of South African refugees in New York City. And in the midst of our fellowshipping, someone in the audience just came up and said, "Chris, you speak with a British accent." I say, "Oh, good enough, I speak with a British accent." Okay. Then that same night, I flew to London. And when I got to London, I stayed there with my cousin, who is a gynecologist there and also a political refugee. And in the midst of our fellowshipping out there, somebody again in the audience just says out, "Oh, Chris, you speak with an American accent." for this morning, you can take your pick. What we would like to do is to give you what I call a bird's eye view of this socio-political history. We only touch the high points. It is also equally evident that the issue of the history of South Africa does not necessarily begin with the year 1652. We have only used that year because it is central in terms of the meeting of the two cultures, the black culture on the one hand and the European culture on the other. So that the year 1652 marks the beginning of the colonial history of the subcontinent. The significance of that, of course, is that for a while, the Dutch East India Company, which was responsible for the settlement in 1652, dealt with the indigenous population rather amicably. Of course, they needed that, because they needed to create some kind of rapport with the people or the aborigines of or the natives of the Cape Colony, of the then Cape Colony. So that for a while we had some kind of minimal, or I call it quasi, give and take between the colonialists and the indigenous people. There were such things, for example, as the bartering of cattle for some sort of spice from the Western world, as well as from the India, because the settlement was predominantly for a refueling station of the Dutch ships that were moving either from India to Europe or vice versa. But this quasi-cordiality was short-lived, for by 1774, with the Barting settlement, the Dutch Reformed Church made the statement that it is not good for whites to mix freely or intermingle with the indigenous population, to intermingle with the black population. So that as early as that, the polarities between the two cultures began to manifest themselves. So much for that kind of polarization between the two cultures. Another significant date, just so as we have a kind of a schema to follow in order to see how this social history represents itself, is the year 1806. 1806. In 1806, as you may well remember, the Cape Colony changed hands from the Dutch into the British. The British annexed the Cape Colony, and then it became part of the British Empire. There are two significant things that happened during this time. One is that by virtue of the anti-slavery laws that the British Parliament had already enacted at this point in time, therefore, when they annexed the Cape, they brought into the colony a new liberalism. That's one thing. This liberalism had, clashed head-on with the rather conservative Boer mentality or Dutch mentality, which reached a crisis in 1835 when the Dutch colonialists decided to leave the Cape Colony as a way of protesting what they thought was the liberalizing of the system, which they could not take at that point in time. They then emigrated further inland into the Orange Free State, which I pointed to earlier, and later to the Transvaal, and there founded two Boer republics, or Dutch republics. Fortunately for the new republics, in 1865, gold was discovered in the Transvaal, as well as along the Orange River. Subsequent to that, there also were large deposits of alluvial diamonds along the Orange River. That made the two republics rather lucrative. And with that came also the British imperialism. So what the British did was to move into further along the coast from the Cape Colony. They went up to so that they would have the Boer Republics landlocked. They moved into Natal and annexed Natal in 1843. And thus, encapsulating the Boer Republic, so that if they wanted to ship the gold out of their republics, they had to do that through Natal, through the port of Durban, which I mentioned earlier, as well as Cape Town, which was at that time the major seaport. But to date, Durban is the major, is South Africa's major seaport with a containerization program now, so it's fairly modern. This conflict between the two white groups reached something of a peak or climax in what the South African historians call the Anglo-Boer War of the 1900, or the turn of the century, the Anglo-Boer War, over which they were squabbling over the resources of the two republics, because the Boers were very resisted the British by every means possible, so that the only way that the British could encroach that part of the republics was through war. They fought, and the Boers lost the war to the British, but at a great cost in terms of manpower, in terms of the resources, so that Great Britain could no longer afford to carry the burden of these new colonies. So what Great Britain did was to free South Africa, so that in 1910, the Union of South Africa was found. the Union of South Africa was formed. And again, another significant thing with 1910 is that when the Union Constitution was formed, the black population was neither consulted nor given any form of representation in the new state. So that the year 1910 represents, in terms of black aspirations, the year during which they lost their birthright. So when you talk of the year 1910, which epitomizes the independence for the Union of South Africa, that for us represents the time during which we were deprived of our birthright. The next significant year, if one really speaks of this social history, is 1948. For a while, I would say between 1910 and about 1947, the new state, the Union of South Africa, tried by various means to liberalize the system and move towards what I call quasi-multiracial state. But that too was short-lived because the Afrikaner maintained this exclusiveness that, you know, the two groups, the black on the one hand and the white, should not meet under no circumstances. So that even though the Union government tried to liberalize a little bit, for example, they created such things as the Native Representative Council, they built schools for blacks, they subsidized mission schools at this point in time and tried to move somehow into South Africa away from an exclusive society to some kind of inclusive society. The elite, for example, were given an exemption status, which meant that, you know, if you were black and you were in the urban South Africa, you could at this time have lease rights within the urban constituency. But that then was short-lived because in 1948, racism was legalized in South Africa. Because in 1948, the Nationalist Party had a resounding majority. And again, I wish to underscore that when we talk about the resounding majority, we are talking about an exclusively white majority, because blacks in South Africa have no vote at all. So that when we talk about that majority, it was a majority of what I call, quote unquote, the white oligarchy. Let us then backtrack a little bit. We have given a kind of bird's eye view of one level of this social history, and that level has been how the whites, you know, took over the country. We like now to backtrack a little bit and focus on what I call the plight of my people, or simply the black response. Right from the moment of the first settlers in 1652, blacks did not relinquish their land freely. First, they sort of gave the white settlers what I call the benefit of a doubt. Therefore, they traded with them through the barter system, as we mentioned earlier. But as friction began in the 18th century, blacks resorted also to answering that kind of polarization by aggressive means. We have in our South African history books, this history between 1652 and 1900 is the history which is called the history of the frontier wars, where there were bitter wars between the encroaching colonialists on the one hand and the indigenous population, where blacks by various means tried to obliterate the camps of the settlers. So that now between this span of 1652 through 1900, we have the era of the frontier wars. But finally, the black population could not resist the bayonet by through sticks. So they were, the sticks or their warfare just could not match the bayonet. So at the point of the barrel, the white minority of South Africa survived or prevailed. When in 1910, South Africa became the Union, the black population decided then that they would answer that by forming a civil rights movement. Perhaps to also give a little background here of how this civil rights movement began, or what were the kind of circumstances that preceded it. In about 1835, the great mission movements from Europe, from all the major historical churches in Europe, began. And then a lot of the historical churches began mission work all over throughout the Republic of South Africa at that time, or the Union of South Africa at that time. And most of the elite then that in 1912 formed the African National Congress came from those mission schools or those mission bodies. And some of these elite had themselves been able to study here in the United States at places like Yale and Harvard. Others had studied at Cambridge and Oxford in Great Britain. So when they came back, realizing that, you know, it could no longer be a question of frontier wars, they had lost the wars, so they had to think of new strategies whereby they could begin to use or mobilize for some kind of muscle power. They did so then by forming in 1912 this African National Congress. Two things epitomize this civil rights movement. First, it was focused on nonviolence as its central motif. Secondly, it sought to aggressively utilize all the existing forums that were provided by the Union Constitution, such as the Native Representative Council, the Colored Representative Council, and colored in South Africa means people of color or people of mixed blood, and the Indian Congress, which represented all Asians in South Africa. All these bodies came under the umbrella of the African National Congress. With the radical change of 1948, which, as I intimated earlier, represented a time during which in South Africa racism was legalized. With that, being traumatized by that experience then, in 1949, the African National Congress sought to review its strategy. Two things happened. First, they said, well, we are going to maintain the nonviolent motif as a strategy for social transformation. But rather than resort to some kind of an aggressive program of using the forums that have been presented us by the powers that be, we would now resort, and this marks the difference, to what is known in politics as civil disobedience. So there was an element of radicalization of the African National Congress at that point in time in 1949. So that between 1950, for example, and 1960, we saw in South Africa an unprecedented civil rights struggle. There were sit-ins, there were strikes, well-organized efforts throughout the country of boycotts of things, I mean, of all the things that epitomize the machinery of our oppression. This culminated in 1960 with the banning of the African National Congress. It was outlawed and brutally repressed. I mentioned earlier that in this magazine here, we have some of the enactments or the laws that, you know, relate to this time. In the introduction here, the mechanism then of repression, this whole page is full of all the laws. I just read the headlines for you, just to give you an inclination. First was the Bantu Administration Act. Second was the Suppression of Communism Act. Third was the Bantu Consolidation Act. Next was the Population Resuscitation Act, which compels people to obtain a racial classification and be registered accordingly. Next is the Native Act. Another is the Bantu Labor Act, and I would like to read it to you because it's so significant. This act prohibits strikes of any sort by Africans, including work slowdowns or joint resignations intended to induce or compel an employer to accept certain proposals, change conditions of employment, or hire or fire another employee, unquote. The other act is the Industrial Conciliation Act, and I'd like to read to you an extract of that. This became the act of an act in 1956. This law prohibits Africans from being members of a registered trade unions and allows the Minister of Labor to regulate the racial composition of employment in certain industries and or occupations. This policy of job reservation allots the most highly skilled and best paying jobs to whites, and I would include exclusively. The next act was the Immorality Act, which, quote, converts into a criminal act sexual intercourse between persons of different races, unquote. The other act is the Prisons Act of 1959. This act restricts the publication of information on prison conditions and prisoners, including treatment of political and other inmates, unquote. The next act is the Unlawful Organization Act, and that too I would like to read. The state president may declare that any existing organization is an already unlawful organization and its members will be liable to prosecution. Similar powers of dissolution are vested in the state president if, in his opinion, a new movement has been formed to advance the aims of, or if it is furthering the aims of, any banned organization. This suffices to give you just an inkling of what these laws, you know, these racial laws, which led to the suppression and the banning of the African National Congress in 1960 are. So that by right, in terms of the social history of South Africa, between the years 1960 and 65, there existed in South Africa no concerted or organized civil rights struggle, because then the African National Congress was dealt with a final blow in the Benin Order of 1960. So what it did, it moved into exile and there further radicalized into a freedom-fighting army of South Africa. Besides that then, the moving of the struggle externally, internally everything went underground. And I remember, because I was at college at the time, I remember that in our own seminaries, which by right really were free institutions of the church, and we could discuss political issues there, but because of fear of the laws that I have already indicated to you, and also an extensive informal system, the South African government pays a lot to have blacks, to set black against black, so that they operate on a here, on a gossip sub type of a thing. You know, if anyone, for example, in my own parish, if I preach what I call quote unquote a quasi political sermon, one of my parishioners, you know, who is paid and really, I mean, has surveillance on me, would give them the text or even come in with a tape recorder to record my statement so that, you know, the police can use it as a form of intimidation. With those kinds of constraints, then the word politics in South Africa between 1960 and 65 was tabooed. Nobody dared to speak about that. Not only was the intimidation only a result of informers, but also it was the result of what I call, quote-unquote, brute force. In 1960, for example, at a protest march in outside of Johannesburg, 15 miles south of Johannesburg, at a small town called Vereeniging, 69 blacks were shot dead by the police, and over 100 injured. And many of us had had that experience as we were at university, and therefore, because of that, tended to keep a low profile. The big question then is, if that is the case, if from 1960 on through 65, there was no concerted civil rights organization in Southern Africa, so what? Or if not, that is a tragic situation indeed. It was only through the church efforts of all the historical churches in Southern Africa, pulling their resources together through what was then called the University Christian Movement, which was only a Christian student movement, that the dream was rekindled. In 1968, January, at the University Christian Movement consultation in Stadtheim, in the Cape, black students decided to try it one more time, or go at it one more time. They decided that because we have been intimidated so thoroughly, it was high time that we began to mobilize and regroup one more time. And for that, we utilized the forum of the University Christian Movement to do so. In 1968, December, at a Catholic high school in Maryhill near Durban, a number of us who were student representatives in our various campuses, which comprise of university campuses, seminary, and teacher training colleges, met at Maryhill and founded what is now called the South African Student Organization, of which Stephen Biko was president. This organization marks the beginning of the Black Consciousness Movement of South Africa. In a nutshell, the Black Consciousness Movement sought to do two things. Perhaps rather than define the problem in external or in structural terms, such as the African National Congress had tended to do, we began to do what I call an introspection. We began to see, to say to ourselves, what is it that has made us so, that has intimidated us so much so that we were willing to further our own oppression, such as the kind of silence that was our experience at our universities. We began to ask the question, why? Is it only sufficient that because I know there will be an informer in my audience to maintain my peace? In order to circumvent this, we began what we call self-help programs, where student leaders congregated at strategic points and began to talk about this psychological oppression, about this giving in to the powers that be. We talked about our own accepting of what we call, quote-unquote, the inferiority complex, which paralyzed us. We began then to utilize our own soul force to begin to enhance and reenact the dream one more time. And we did so by the resources that were made available to us by the South African Council of Churches for one thing and the University Christian Movement for another. We had at our disposal, for example, even in 1968 December, we had at our disposal Martin Luther King tape, I Have a Dream. We had, for example, Malcolm X book, biography of Malcolm X. We had various such things, you know, that helped us to begin to reassert ourselves and appeal to our own African ethos as an incentive for regrouping one more time. Having done that for ourselves through group dynamics, we began to move a step further by establishing projects throughout the campuses whereby we began to share some of the gains that we thought we had experienced. It was then by no accident that in 1976, this struggle had reached that kind of level of sensitivity that the students were willing to move into the streets one more time in protest. In 1976, May, the students congregated in all the high schools in Soweto, the higher primary schools or secondary education schools, moved into the streets in protest against the imposition of Afrikaans as a medium of instruction. It was not just a question of rejecting the Africana per se, as it was the question of saying that, you know, we do not learn to have a third language imposed into our academic system, since we already had English as a medium of instruction in all the high school, or from higher primary on, English was the medium of instruction, as well along with your own vernacular. So we did not want to see imposed this third language requirement that the government was imposing, let alone that as a requirement, but more, they wanted to change the whole educational system and make Afrikaans, which is really only the language of South Africa because it is neither Dutch nor German, so that you couldn't even use it if you went to graduate school. And we would take it no longer. And consequently, with the mobilization of the Soweto Student Representative Council, the student moved in the street and made the headlines internationally. Unfortunately, this culminated in the death of my friend Stephen Biko, who died under police custody the same year, in 1977, in September the 12th. And again, in 1978, this struggle itself was banned. And then consequently became an affected organization. And what that meant is that, you know, anyone that quoted from all the resources and the documentation that we had built for this struggle would be subject to the Suppression of Communism Act, which really means a minimum of 180 days detention without trial. And if you are brought into trial, it has the minimum of 5 years to the maximum of death or life sentence. Merely for talking politics. This is not that, you know, probably you have committed an act of sabotage, but merely using the resources of the so-called quote-unquote affected organization would bring you those kinds of constraints. And I think I'd like to stop here for a little bit and then open this to a dialogue of some form so that we can begin to discuss. I've just given you a bird's eye view of the situation. And I'd like for us at this point to break and begin to open up and feed in your questions. Yes, sir.
What's the difference between the Rhodesian policy and the South African policy for its life?
There are major differences. And in fact, the Zimbabwean situation, even prior to the new state, the Rhodesia, even though it had segregation laws, it was more like in the south of the United States. That's one thing which is very significant, since in South Africa we have never been moved seriously or aggressively enough into some form of a multiracial state. Okay? We have never had that. They did try a little bit during the United Party reign in 1910 on, but that was short-lived. That's one point of difference. The other point of difference is that with Rhodesia, when the declaration of the UDI in Rhodesia was such an anathema for the international community that they began to react to that immediately. That's one major difference. That, you know, they then, Rhodesia was was banned. No country traded with Rhodesia except for Africa. I beg your pardon, for the Republic of South Africa. And that was significant because then it put a severe constraint on the economy, which precipitated to both Bishop Muzorewa and Ian Smith going to the London conference. And I wish to underscore that by saying too that the significance of the sanctions against Rhodesia really create for me a precedent of the necessity of a negotiated settlement for the Republic of South Africa. For here we have people that were fighting, were at war too, you know, and the fighting forces, the freedom fighters in Zimbabwe were fairly well equipped, so that it was a real serious war and large numbers involved. Here were people that were, polarized to the ultimate, yet at the same time moved to a constitutional conference in London. And the reason they did that was the pressure that both the United States and Great Britain used in order to use their leverage in order to get the conference going. And both things have not taken place with respect to the Republic of South Africa. Somehow people are hoping that out of goodwill, Prime Minister Botha and his cabinet will sort of deliver on the promises that they are making, even though they are the only made in order to disarm suspicion of the international community. And that's one thing I wanted to say in respect to that question. There was a question over here. The blacks of South Africa have always tried. Of course, I know that now when you talk of the external struggle, there is split between the Pan-Africanist Congress on the one hand and the African National Congress, both of which have observer status at the United Nations. The African National Congress is still very much an integrated body. The Pan-Africanist Congress, by virtue of the name, has less people of color. It is also not exclusive, but at least has not the same, numerically doesn't have as many whites as does the African National Congress, which has in its own executive all the people from South Africa, including some liberal Jews, liberal English-speaking South Africans, as well as the majority, of course, of the black population. Included in that, all the major tribal affiliations from South Africa. But they have been fighting, you know, externally out of the Republic since 1960, so that over 10 years have gone with them fighting away, in fact over 20 years now have gone for them involved in an external struggle that somehow, sometimes they don't always have the ties with the internal constituency, since they are, both organizations are banned. So that, you know, the Black Consciousness Movement has come up to fill that gap, for one thing. But again, significant, and this relates directly to your question, the Black Consciousness Movement comprises of all black people of South Africa, just like the African National Congress.
What is the population difference
between
the black and the white?
Yeah, that's a good question. The population difference, there are 4.5 million whites in South Africa vis-a-vis 21 million black people. I will read to you the statement of Mr. Botha, the so-called, you know, P.W. Botha's 12-point plan. And this is what the American media has exploited to the ultimate. And I'll read it to you and then comment a little bit later. The first point, the recognition and acceptance of the existence of multinationalism and of minorities in South Africa. The acceptance of a vertical differentiation with a built-in principle of self-determination on as many levels as possible. That's the second point. The establishment of constitutional structures which provide for the full independence of various black nations in the Republic of South Africa. Meaningful consolidation of black states and areas, and the acceptance of a socio-economic program aimed at development of such black states and areas. The division of power among white South Africans, coloreds, and South African Indians within a system of consultation and joint responsibility where common interests are at issue. The acceptance of the principle that each group should have its own schools and communities where possible as fundamental to happy social circumstances. The willingness to work together as equals and consult on issues of common concern while maintaining a healthy balance between the rights of the individual and those of the community, and the removal of unnecessary, hateful forms of discrimination. The maintenance of effective decision-making by the state, founded on strong defense force and police force to ensure orderly government as well as sound, efficient administration. The maintenance of a free enterprise as the basis of our economic policy. The recognition of economic interdependence of the population groups of the Republic of South Africa, as well as the acceptance of the properly planned utilization of manpower. The goal of a peaceful constellation of Southern Africa states, respecting one another's cultural heritage traditions, and ideals. As far as possible, South Africa must follow a policy of neutrality in the confrontation between the superpowers and give priority to her own interests. South Africa's determination to defend itself against outside intervention in every practical way possible. I mean, you can see, and this is the statement that Prime Minister Botha used in his campaign for the recent election in South Africa. And that is supposedly, quote unquote, to be the liberalizing of the system. I wish just only to say one point as a way of registering my protest to the so-called to this kind of liberalizing program, in that, you know, it does not mention black population. What they meant here by the homeland system was that, you know, only 17% of South Africa's landscape, and therefore 83% of South Africa's geographical area and resources, will belong to the white minority. And the so-called black states will be then interspersed within this 17% land area. And we would have no parliamentary representation in the so-called new constitution. So that they remain persona non grata in the country of their own birth. And that is what the media and possibly the present government is beginning to take for granted and negotiate on. And it seems to me that if the present government is maybe really falling into the trap of what I call taking the Afrikaner for granted, you know, they underestimate the intelligence of the Afrikaner in terms of his overt and ulterior motives in terms of building in a new system. So what they are doing now, they are branding this era that we are moving away from so-called petty apartheid, which meant the segregation of amenities through racial groups. We are moving away from that into so-called multinational state, whereby they would have a consultative body for the colored South African and the Asian South African. And for the black population of some 15 million people, they will only consult through what they call homeland policy representation. And those are being pushed one by one into what they call quasi-independence. And none of these so-called independent states are economically viable. A question again. Does this answer your question? Okay. Yeah. Again, would you repeat the question just a second? Yes, they do. Yeah, if you have seen the film, The Last Grave at Dimbaza, it really epitomizes that. It shows how the government, the so-called decentralization program has really denied the human rights of these people, because they are shipped into an area where there is no sanitation, there is no sewage system, and therefore, as the title of the film epitomizes, The Last Grave in Dibanza, it shows the infant mortality in the so-called resettlemental area. And one area also that helps to underscore that is that the life expectancy within the infant mortality of any given homeland to date is that 50% of the children born in any of the homelands never reach age 5. That's how great these so-called homelands are. I cannot tell you my opinion on that for reasons that, you know, this is an act of treason in South Africa. So if you indulge in talking and at least, you know, in pushing that to its limit, then you are liable for prosecution. And that is why, that's the reason why most South Africans really never address that issue directly. They rather leave it as an issue of conscience for the people that are doing, given all the facts, what do they think is feasible. But again, I would only refer to what the people themselves within the confines of the Republic of South Africa have said. And I mean, I'm thinking at this point in time of the South African Council of Churches, especially its executive. In a recent statement, they have endorsed divestment as the minimum step in terms of putting pressure on the South African state and move it towards a constitutional conference. And they call this, that is, the minimum of that will be divestment. Realizing that divestment alone cannot transform South Africa, since it's a viable medium economy, so that, you know, I mean, it will not be hurt by nothing less than, you know, a well-strategized economic sanction program involving all the trading partners of the Republic of South Africa. So what the South African Council of Churches has called for, as well as the Christian Institute, is that divestment be the minimum, and moving towards now writing Congress and having the State Department use its own leverage to begin to do what Great Britain did for Zimbabwe, namely to push for a constitutional conference where all the group affiliations or the people that are involved in the Republic of South Africa would come to a constitutional conference and hit a new constitution for the country. And failing which, if they don't do that, then they would push for economic sanction and total isolation of the apartheid state. Yes, Larry. That's a difficult question, really, to react to, because of the complexity of the matter, in terms of the economic ties that, you know, the United States has and enjoys with South Africa. That's one major variable. The other is and even more probably poignant, is that and probably positive. Is that unlike the Carter government, which I think, you know, was doing the right things in terms of putting pressure and prioritizing or pushing to the first priority the issue of human rights, that was very good. But that they did, the Carter administration did, only as what I call a guard level type of interaction within the State Department of the United States. When it came to delivering, then there were all kinds of discrepancies, including the things that befell people like Andrew Young. And McHenry afterwards just did not do anything. He did not push as much as that, so it just became a rubber stamp. And in that sense, then I sense a dichotomy between what I thought good intentions on the one hand and delivering on those kinds of promises on the other. So that was the dichotomy of the Carter administration. But again, to push the issue of the Reagan administration, if there is anything that would be for me would be, even though I'm talking about, you know, a narrow light in a tunnel, is that perhaps because they present an affront of conservative government, whatever that means, okay? I think they are up to understand, you know, if the Reagan administration should push the apartheid state and say, negotiate. For example, that's what Clark was doing this week in South Africa, for example, over the Namibian issue. They are pushing that South Africa should move into negotiating with SAPO some kind of peaceful change in Namibia. I think because the Reagan administration, has already promised and operates under the so-called quote-unquote anti-communism stance, Botha is up to negotiate with them, realizing that, you know, he has only 4 years to negotiate with this present government because we don't know what's going to happen next and whether or not the incoming government, say in 1984, would be as empathic to the republic. So that I think it is a matter of common sense for me that they might be more inclined to take the present administration seriously in terms of moving to some kind of a negotiated settlement. What bothers me yet is that the present government has made no mention of the apartheid thing. All they are talking about at this point in time is Namibia. So that the plight of my people remains intact for the Reagan administration, and that causes me the qualm.
Well, in the 12 points you read in that article, I don't think I did, anything about the repulsion of the racist laws that they passed in 1960.
They have not, and that's part of the contradiction.
Well, that's right. How can things change then if they don't?
They will not.
They're not sure.
Yeah. That's why I say that, you know, so far the present government has said nothing to those issues. They are only speaking to the international issue, which has become a thorn in the flesh at the UN, the Namibian question. So that is what they are focusing on.
Well, in the economic sanction of the country, don't you think that it's an almost impossible thing because of the value and the need of the products that come out of South Africa by these other countries?
I think that's a very good question. My own reaction to that is that, you know, I mean, evolutionary change or peaceful change in South Africa is really a good thing, and all of us really, hope and at least pray that that be the route that the Republic would go through. But there are serious constraints. In South Africa today, it's no longer a question of when change. It is rather a question of how the change is going to take place. And there remains two options, because right at this point in time, there is, quote unquote, freedom fighting going on at the borders of South Africa. So that given that constraint on the one hand, we are faced with an inevitable bloodbath. The reason then that some have pushed for some kind of selected, you know, well-targeted economic sanctions against South Africa. South Africa, for example, remains very vulnerable in terms of fuel, for example. It remains very vulnerable in certain capital projects. They need even hard cash for those things, because the gold standard, which has created a windfall profit for them, is only used to offset the high energy costs, to maintain the vibrant economy that the government has at this present time. So that being one of the targets would move the state into a negotiated settlement in no time. For they know as well as I do that these 4.5 million people cannot win a war. That they already know. But they are buying time. And what is going to happen if nothing and trading partners of South Africa take seriously this thing, you know, and really move aggressively, then what is going to happen is that more and more young blacks are going to be moving out to train, because that's the only way. The option of accepting the status quo is no longer attainable.
Words free enterprise. Now, I want to understand what that might mean in terms of the state itself, but was there anything behind that, was there any meaningful thing behind that in pre-enterprise for blacks?
Okay, let me just, give you, I'll answer that in terms of social programs. Because in terms of income levels, the figures are appalling. For example, the government spends per capita, per child, in elementary school in South Africa, for the whites, $600, and only $40 per capita per a black child. So that the black education in South Africa is a community-oriented schools, which the government subsidizes on those bases that I've already indicated. And that's just one program that would make for transformation. And also given the history that this is a country which has had rigid job reservation acts, this is a country that survives to date through the migratory labor system, which has been left intact, where the miners, in spite of the windfall profit, and this is one good thing with this here, church investment in the apartheid state, because it really gives the statistics as to how many, of the income levels, the GNP and all those kinds of incentives are given here to show the discrepancy phenomenon in South Africa. So that when they talk about free enterprise for the black states, they are talking about the economies of the homelands, none of which are viable. That's one reason. And if you talk about, the upper echelons in South Africa in terms of the upward mobility, the minimal upward mobility that may occur within this structure, you are talking of less than 0.05%. So that is less than a drop in the bucket of so-called, quote-unquote, black entrepreneur.